Good afternoon. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and distinguished lecturer emeritus from York College, City University of New York. I welcome you to this March 30th coronavirus pandemic edition of Vantage Point here on 99.5 FM. That's WBAI, of course, on the Pacifica Network in collaboration with ycradio.org. Well, today we will continue our phenomenal Black Woman series. Ashley is entitled The Essence of Susan L. Taylor, Phenomenal Black Woman. And we'll get some updates on the coronavirus crisis at the end of the show. But before we do that, I just want to start by saying keep the faith. I heard the tips that were given out through the joint broadcast with WPFW. Take a deep breath and take your mind off things. We will get through this. Keep the faith and be safe. The mayor of New York has had to take down the hoops from the basketball court because, you know, the Bloods of brothers have wanted to go out and do hooping. It's just not safe. We have to be disciplined enough to keep our social distance. It's working in other cities, and it will soon work here in New York. This is a deadly crisis, but it's not one that we need panic about if we just take the precautions and do all the things that we're being asked to do. The Institute of the Black World 21st Century, as I mentioned last week, has excellent resources also on our website, ibw21.org, ibw21.org. We urge you to go there and sort through all the different articles and essays and advice. There's just a number of things that are coming together. IBW has been very much involved in the last week, actually, in pulling together a major group of people from the Black Family Summit, a configuration of socially conscious Black professional organizations to deal with the crisis. We've just issued a press release today talking about that. Are we really trying to get credible messengers who can give you accurate information, because we don't want myths and misinformation and disinformation out here. So we're working to correct that. And we're hoping to, you know, partner with even WBAI and WPFW to get some of those messengers on the air. One of them will be rejoining me at the end of the last segment of the show, Brother Yusuf Muhammad. So you can go to the website, ibw21.org, ibw21.org, and you will see those resources. So again, we just want everybody to be safe. Take a deep breath, as has been said. Find things to do at home, you know, and, you know, entertain yourself. It is not easy, but this too will pass. And on the other end, hopefully we will have learned some things. Hopefully this nation will have learned some things that will make sure that it never, ever is as unprepared as this nation was for this one moving forward. But as I said before, this is the last of our Phenomenal Black Women series, and I'm delighted. Oh, by the way, we had tremendous feedback, just tremendous feedback last week with the interview with Tarana Burke, the founder of the hashtag MeToo movement. And you can go to the website, ibw21.org. We reposted it. It's getting tremendous feedback, discussion, debate, and whatever at ibw21.org. But delighted to conclude the series with someone who really needs no introduction. You just say Essence and Essence Magazine, and that's all you need to know about this remarkable, phenomenal woman who's a game changer. Her work as an iconic figure, a leader, a journalist, someone who cares deeply about about black people and humanity was a game changer. It changed the way that we look at ourselves, not only in terms of our physical attributes, but our souls and our sense of how we take care of ourselves. She's a healer, as well as many other things. And so it's my privilege to welcome to our show none other than Susan L. Taylor. Susan, welcome to Vantage Point.
Okay, Professor, she's not answering right now. We're trying to get in touch with her. I'm still trying to get in touch with her, but at the moment, she is not on the air.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we'll continue on. I'm sure that she'll be here momentarily, hopefully. I mean, I just actually saw something from her because her organization, National Cares Mentoring, is having, was reporting on a major webinar with the National Chamber of Commerce and so forth. So these are issues that we really, again, want to continue to pay attention to. I just want to reiterate, and we're proud to be on WBAI and the Pacifica Network, which is very much involved in helping to keep the information out, to keep sharing that information.
Okay, she's available.
To keep us safe, and we want to continue to have you be that. So I'm glad we now have our dear beloved sister, Susan Taylor. Again, we've called this the essence of Susan Taylor, phenomenal black woman. I already have introduced her, game changer, iconic, so many words to describe our dear beloved sister. Susan Taylor, my dear beloved sister, welcome to Vantage Point.
When I am totally lost in email and trying to figure out how we, who are leading nonprofits, in fact, you're in this missive that I'm sending out, can be sure that we're at the front of the line and not at the back of the line when those stimulus funds are really made available to nonprofits.
Right.
The forgivable loans is really what I'm talking about. So forgive me for being a few minutes late. I was trying to push send, but I'll get back to it.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I was just telling people that I had just saw, I didn't get a chance to read it all, but I saw the email that you were sending out. What I wanted, and you're beginning where I would like to begin, and that's with any word that you have to our audience about what we should be doing, the seriousness of this crisis, and how we should handle it.
You know, it's really stunning that so many of the deaths are right here in New York City. It's stunning. And death anywhere caused by a virus that nobody really fully understands is devastating. I won't call it it's not a silver lining, but we all know that every loss in our lives taught us something. And, you know, the air is cleaner, the dolphins are jumping again in Venice, in the waters, and there's less pollution in China. And I'm not saying that this is something sent from beyond, but it's here. And I believe in the divine hand in everything. Hmm. It's organizing people in a way that folks have not been organized before. It's while we're sequestered, some people are kind of losing it because they don't like being alone. We have to now get reintroduced to our very best friend, ourselves, and that spirit within that is always available, always waiting for us to connect. So this is a time for new learning. People may want to learn new languages. They may want to learn how to be in relationship better if they're sharing their homes with people. Connecting in the virtual space is a beautiful thing as well. People are writing, completing books that, you know, they've had on the shelf or in process for years. So I think that what we should be doing is just taking time to think about what really matters in life. What's really important? What is important to each of us? And where do we want to be and how do we want to be? When this pandemic retreats, we're going to come out of it differently. And I just think we should come out of it as better individuals, as a better community of activists, as a better nation, hopefully in a better world.
Well, that's what makes Susan Taylor Susan Taylor. I mean, just the remarkable way in which you have to teach and to reach and touch people is, again, what I described in terms of introducing you. And that's what you did at Essence Magazine. I mean, you were, it was not just a magazine. It was more than that. So, Susan, what we want to do, because this is our Phenomenal Black Woman's concluding series, actually, for Women's History Month, just to talk a little bit about you and your origins, for example, your education, a little bit about your influences. What makes Susan Taylor Susan Taylor?
Oh, it's everything, you know. Growing up in Harlem as I did, growing up in my father's store, my father came from St. Kitts, and gosh, he was 21 and married my mother in Harlem. She came from Trinidad. And in 1936, my father opened Larry's Specialty Shop, his women's boutique. He put my mother, I'm not going to say he put my mother because nobody ever put my mother anywhere. She worked in that store while he worked downtown. And when the store could support the two of them, 10 years later, they had my brother and then me. And so I grew up right there in my father's store and in the tenement above him on the second floor and needed those four eyes on me, but I still broke through. And, you know, educated in public school at first and then in the local Catholic school, and then when heroin really just ran roughshod through Harlem and everything collapsed. My friends' parents were the first ones that I saw falling. And those of us, those families who had the resources, fled. We fled to Queens. Other people fled to New Jersey and the Bronx and Brooklyn. And the people we left behind, Ron, and it breaks my heart to say this, not one of my friends who we left behind survived.
Oh,
not one.
Oh,
they were the children of single parents, you know? And those mothers did not have, and fathers, because Mr. Mundelein was right there raising his daughter. And so I moved to Queens, and it was a new world, a different world for us. Bicycles and, you know, the barbershop around the corner where Mr. Floyd had his wonderful parties for us on Saturday night. We could go cooking classes. Parents involved, you know, no danger in the streets as what was happening in Harlem. And, you know, went to school there, graduated from John Adams. I come from a Caribbean family that never said, go to college. Never. My brother went right on to City College, going at night, working during the day. What I heard from my family was, you know, start a business and buy a home. That's
wow.
What I did. I started a business. I got married very young at 20. I started Nikoi Cosmetics. I had my daughter at 23. The cosmetics company was absolutely successful right there on 167th Street, the Grand Concourse, Nikoi Cosmetics. It came to the attention of the Essence editors in 1970, the year that the magazine was given birth to, and I was hired as the beauty editor because at that time, you know, it was the height of the Black Power movement.
Right.
And women who had journalism degrees weren't interested in writing about anything as mundane as beauty. So as a licensed cosmetologist and a not good actress, which is what I thought I wanted to be, but I wasn't good, and I stepped away from that and did what was really a passion of mine, which was, you know, beauty and trying to create what wasn't available. And we didn't have shades for us at that time, Ron. There were no shades for Black women. So that's what I created, led me to Essence. And I became editor-in-chief of Essence how many years later? 10 years later, and had never gone to college up until that point.
Mm.
And when I would ask people, well, don't you think I need to go back to school? I feel like, I mean, I know James Baldwin and Toni Morrison and, you know, Alice Walker and some of the great minds, but I haven't read any of those books. Not a person said, go to school. Everybody said, oh, you already have what we want. You know, you're making money and you're well known. And this is just to say that nobody knows what's best for you better than you.
Oh, wow.
I had to really put my ego behind me, which is what I did. I lived right across the street from Fordham University, right there on Broadway is where I lived, between Central Park West and Broadway and 64th Street. And Fordham University, the downtown campus, up to the, you know, the one that's not in the Bronx, was right across the street. And I decided to go there because it was nearby and I was still raising my daughter. And that's what I did. I went every day I could before work, after work, Saturdays, summers, and, you know, got a degree and went on to Union Theological Seminary. So that's, I didn't graduate from Union. I was jumping and I thought I was having a nervous breakdown trying to write an editorial, raise my daughter, continue with school, run the magazine, eyewear, hosiery. By that time, Essence was huge. Right. And we had, you know, the Essence Award. So that's really, that's in a long capsule of what, or a big capsule of, you know, my life.
No, that's a wonderful capsule because it's also important. People often see a Susan Taylor, a Danny Glover, or Maya Angelou, and whomever. But I always want to get people to understand how people become what they are. And I think we find that people really like that a great deal. Let's talk about Essence. What was your sort of vision for Essence as you became editor-in-chief? Because, you just took it to a whole different level. And it was not just a magazine. It was much more. I mean, and so I just want you to talk about what your vision was for Essence Magazine and how you saw it being situated in the times that we were in.
You know, it's so interesting for you to ask that question because sometimes what you don't know about something frees you to be a creative engine, an innovator. When the position, there was an editor between Marsha Ann Gillespie, we always have to call her name and bow down.
Yes.
Because she was actually the third editor of Essence, fourth, and created the foundation that I built upon. But there was one person between us whose name I just never mentioned because the magazine wasn't thriving under her, which is how they reached for me. You know, brilliant woman who worked with Marsha for about 8 years, and under her leadership, the magazine began to lose circulation. And one night, the publisher took me out and said that he was thinking about me to lead the magazine. I have to tell you the truth, I laughed. I just said, me? There's no way. I'm beauty editor. And if you look at the structure of a magazine, you have the editor-in-chief, the editor, the managing editor, all the, you know, chief editors. And I was managing covers, fashion, and beauty. And, of course, it was health and food and, you know, all the other different sections. So I just laughed and said, there's no way. I came home that evening from a dinner that he really wanted to have with me, Ed Lewis, and I called the man who was in my life, and I always have to call his name, Melbourne Nunes, a brother who grew up in the South Bronx and who was brilliant and went on to Hunter College and then to Columbia University and earned a dual degree in law and an MBA. I called him up. He was my guy. And I said, Mel, this is a joke. You know, Ed Lewis is thinking of me for the editor-in-chief's position. He said, it's no joke. He said, you have exactly what black women need. You know why I tell that story, Ron? Because we have to have people in our lives who see in us what we may not see, who believe in us in a way that we may not believe in ourselves. And because this brother was so smart and just so righteous, I just believed him, went back to work the next day and said I was ready, you know. So when I stepped into that position, I can't say that I stepped in with confidence about what I thought the magazine could be and how I could grow it from what Marsha Gillespie had taken it to, you know. But I didn't know what I could ever write about. I said, what could I write about? Marsha was a brilliant writer, and the person between us was a great writer, journalist. Me? I was writing about fashion and beauty. And what was I interested in? Spirituality. That's where I really spent my time as a single mother and, you know, home with my daughter after that marriage broke up. And I said, I can't follow what Marsha did. I'm just going to write about what I know and what I'm seeking to know more about. And that really led to my column In the Spirit that I think really kind of wedded people to me.
Absolutely.
And what I did was I called a whole, because there was a period of time between the time I knew I was going to become editor-in-chief and I became editor-in-chief, probably about 4 or 5 months. So with some really, I just did some very real critical thinking about what I knew people were going through and asking people what they were going through. You know, it's not genius work, creating content. Creating content means putting your ego behind you, knowing you could have a vision, but the vision for Essence had to be something that had deep meaning and relevancy to the women and then that growing male audience that became 30% of the readers we were serving. So I am a person who is in community, listening to community, serving community, which is what gave birth to the cosmetics company filling a need. And that's really what I brought to Essence with a team of the most amazing minds, wonderful editors, smart editors, people who had skills that I never had, you know?
So, Susan, as you look back on Essence, like, this is probably a tough question, given there were so many. Well, what would you say are maybe two or three of the highlights or great accomplishments under your tenure?
Well, you know, I take great pride when I learned years later that In the Spirit was really the first spiritual offering in a popular American and probably magazine worldwide. That at that time, magazines were not, you know, talking about spirituality at all. It was whatever that magazine's focus was, women's magazines, you know, it was all the stuff that is still there, and now spirituality is everywhere. So I take great pride in that. And I think also, one night I'll tell you something funny. I don't know who, maybe Roll Hardy. He was a DJ, oh gosh, at LIB or a sister station. And one night he was at my house, and he just was going on about what he was angry about with black women, and he wasn't going to be dating us anymore. And rather than throwing him out and getting mad at him, I just said, be quiet and listen. And I listened to what he had to say. And the next day I went back to the editors and I said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to do the first men's issue.
Wow.
Well, you know, a lot of back, what? Men's issue? We're a woman's magazine. What do you mean? We're going to give men their say. Because brothers, there was no place where we could understand what our men were thinking and feeling and what they were going through. And that was the cover. You know, it was our sister was on Broadway. I should call her name right now. My husband's ex-girlfriend, this husband, and lovely, beautiful woman. And George Patterson, I put them on the cover. And one cover line, black men have their say. And that gave birth to what was then the largest selling issue in our history up to that time and became an annual treat. You know, black men's issue.
Wonderful.
Take pride in those two things. A lot of pride.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, you could have just, after all of that, you could have just retired. Your legacy was made. I mean, you could have just retired. But not Susan Taylor. There was life beyond Essence. And you gave birth to an organization and a cause, a passion, a mission, and an organization that I think is equally phenomenal, the National Cares Mentoring. Why?
You know, I can't even say that I sat, laid, prayed, and said, oh, I'm going to really get out here and try to help our children who are losing ground. It was Katrina, you know, that devastated New Orleans. You know that it's the birthplace and still the home of the Essence Festival. And after that, and we lost so many of our friends, it takes thousands of people to produce that festival. We lost so many of our friends and so many of our colleagues and the people who really were boots on the ground in New Orleans for us, well, because we're based, you know, in New York City. And I just said to the Essence family, we cannot go back and do the festival as we have done it before. And I took some of what Hakeem Adebuti had done upstate New York, you know, with it was a black men's spiritual organization, just beautiful, beautiful sharings that we had up there. And I said, I'm going to have speakers come, like he would have speakers come. That's where I met Naeem Akbar, you know, and Aplin Lynch and so many brilliant minds. And so, you know, folks, we're going to do the music. But I said, you know what we're going to do in the second poorest state in this nation? We're going to have something, the people who have no interest in going to a concert or who have no money to buy a ticket. And so that gave birth to what has now become the essential part of the Essence Festival. And that it's the empowerment seminars. So that it was Essence Cares. That's what we launched, Essence Cares. And we had every conscious black leader you can think of there. including the minister. He spoke. And, you know, Jesse Jackson and Maxine Waters, and the list goes on and on and on. And they spoke over 3 days. We asked one thing of our community: go home to your respective cities and please, please get engaged in the lives of our vulnerable children. We were in Houston that year because we couldn't go back into the Superdome because it was being rebuilt. And that didn't happen, and people came to me and said, we need infrastructure. So I couldn't allow people around the country to use the name Essence. So I said, oh, okay, got to find another name, and we have to have CARES in it. And that gave birth to the National CARES Mentoring Movement, a call to action to step into the lives through mentoring organizations, step into the lives of children who are suffering on our watch and who are living in poverty beyond our view, living in shelters, living in homes, foster homes, 10 foster homes and 11 schools in their lifetime, and they're just 14 and 15. So there's so much going on in this, in the lives of our struggling young people that we have no idea of. Nothing do we know about it. And that's the work that I do right now. And I have to tell you, it doesn't feel like work. I love this work. I hate that I have to do it because the community, the country, we've not stepped up. You know, there's a growing divide between the haves and the have-nots. Let me say there was until this virus appeared. And this virus is probably, you know what the virus is? The virus is really, that we've allowed, it's greed. It's greed, and it's a lack of understanding and caring for one another. And now we're all vulnerable. This is the first time in our lifetimes, right, when everybody is connected. We're all affected by one thing.
That's right.
And that's a lesson. That's a lesson in living.
Right. Well, you've done such phenomenal work with National CARES Mentoring, and you because of who you are, people just you're a magnet. So people have come, they've contributed. Again, give people a sense of what the organization does, and to this date, what you see are some of the accomplishments. Because I know every now and then I get a bulletin about this person whose life has been changed and has gone on in such magnificent ways, and so share a little bit of that as we conclude.
All righty. So what we do in 58 cities across the country, we recruit mentors, we train them, and then we deploy them to where they're needed. To schools as reading buddies and tutors and to youth support organizations, and then also to the juvenile detention centers where our children are just, you know, being abused in so many ways. Not in all of them, because in some of them there's some caring and some therapy that our young ones tell us they don't get in the community. We have taken young people to Congress just a few months ago because suicide has spiked among our children. For the first time, it's spiked above white child suicide. And suicide is one of the major, it's the second major cause of death of young people in the United States. So it's not just black kids. It's not just brown kids or Asian kids. It's not just Native Americans. White children were killing themselves at a higher rate than any of the others. And what we have to do is ask ourselves, why are the children so sad?
Right.
And they have told us. So let me just say this last piece and end with that. For any of us who have a hand on any child. So that's what we do in 58 cities. We send mentors. We get them into the pipeline. And we want to see black people in that pipeline because when the call goes out for mentors, it's white women who are typically the first responders. And then white men, and then black women and black men. And we need to show up. Our community needs to show. And this, a white brother of mine said this to me. I have adopted a black child, he said. And I've been foster parent to many black children. But only black people can show black children they are loved and cared for by the community. Amen, right?
Amen.
So we have also, I began these amazing programs. Because one of our leaders down in Fort Lauderdale called me one day frustrated. What do I say to a 17-year-old who already has, you know, two children? I said, a 17-year-old with two children? What? And she worked at a school, Seagull Alternative School. And I was going to be speaking in Miami. And I said, you know, when I'm in Miami, in the next couple of weeks, I'm coming to the school. What I saw, Dr. Ron Daniels, took my breath away. I saw these kids wrestling book bags and baby bags and car seats and babies onto school buses. And the youngest was 12 with three children, and nobody was arrested. She was like, this is impossible. We are not going to leave the capture, the elevation, and the forward movement of our children to anybody but us. And with that, I invited the two women who invited me to Fort Lauderdale down to Miami to meet me there the next day where I had a speaking engagement. And I talked about what I saw with those women in the audience. And I said, we need help. I need help. Who's going to help? And some women stepped out of the audience. And that's when we began to build the Rising, elevating education, expectations, and self-esteem. Couldn't raise a dime. My Angela, my beloved one. Oh, she would sign books for me, the big coffee table book that's the Essence book, and we would try to give, you know, we would raise money that way. But the people down there, the ones who were leading it, never asked for a dime. And we raised no money until Sean Dove came along. Sean Dove, who's the person who really created the campaign for Black Male Achievement, that out of that grew the My Brother's Keeper. And he funded us. He was the first funder. And so that program now is in 7 states. In a host of schools. And what it is a very simple model. It's all auditorium, all school auditorium sessions where we bring in phenomenal speakers and we bring in, you know, healers and teachers who can help people, help our young ones to see that, you know, they may have been incarcerated and homeless and maybe even addicted to drugs, but these are people who transform their lives. So we put those stories before them. And in our wellness mentoring circles that take place very intimately and in classrooms, and they're gender specific. So all the, you know, gender identified specific, the females, the girls are with the girls, the guys are with the guys, anybody who wants to be in the middle, we have, you know, people who can work with every gender. And there are this is what costs so much money, the psychologists who are in those classrooms. And the mentors are volunteers, so we're not paying the mentors. But group mentoring is a way forward because we took 500 of the 1,000 children on the south side of Chicago, Harlan High, with 4 psychologists, about 40 mentors, and sessions every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And they were in classrooms, and we helped 500 of those 1,000 children. We had them in wellness mentoring circles, and all 1,000 of them in different sessions of the larger auditorium sessions with Michael Dyson and Jeff Johnson and a whole host of people coming in to speak life into them and to show them that they are not alone. They're not on the ledge alone. And we, elders, we made mistakes, and we have you. We have your back. But you have to keep your behinds in those chairs, and we're going to help you to learn and grow and thrive and be who we know you want to be.
Well, the fruit from those sessions, oh my goodness, how phenomenal. And the fruit from those, that the seeds that are being planted now are going to last. It's like Maya Angelou, that her saying, strong women and men keep coming. And the work that you're doing through National Cares Mentoring is ensuring that what Maya Angelou spoke is in fact going to continue because of your work. So Susan Taylor, by the way, just tell people how to get in touch, by the way. I got to be a good organizer. How do people get in touch with National Cares Mentoring?
CaresMentoring.org, CaresMentoring.org. And we have our, you know, our community wellness calls every Thursday at 8 p.m. Last week we had, last week we had Freddie Haynes. Dr. Haynes was our speaker. This Thursday it's going to be Dr. William Barber. Next week it'll be Iyanla Van Zandt. Anybody who wants to come on in, just, you know, send an email. Send it to D. Parker, the initial D. Parker. That's Deborah Parker. But just D. Parker at caresmentoring.org. So we're kind of filling up. We can accommodate. We had 147 people on last week. And so we want to make sure that our network around the country and the people who were there last week can get on this week. And we keep expanding the platform. But it's really healing. It's time for healing, and we have meditation at the end, and it's really a great community gathering.
Yes, I think it was Baba Leonard Dunstan or a couple of other people who were on this week, and they talked about how phenomenal it was. And, again, this is a time when that kind of healing, I think people are yearning for it, and an opportunity to bind and bond in the way that you've talked about. Susan L. Taylor, phenomenal Black woman, thank you so much for spending time with us this afternoon on Vantage Point.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Dr. Ron Daniels. You know how I love you and Lady Frances and admire the work that you do. I'm always there. You just tell me, just give me my orders, my marching orders. I'll always be there.
You always are, and I appreciate that so much. Okay, well, another incredible interview with a phenomenal black woman. I just so enjoy being able to have these kinds of interviews where we are able to share and get to know who people really are. Well, we're going to take a, we ran a little bit over time, but we had to because of just the nature of that interview. We want to bring on in a minute, we're going to hold it for a minute. I'm going to take a brief break, about 3 minutes, and we'll be coming back with Yousef Muhammad, who is the co-chair of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century's FEMA Black Family Summit Emergency Management Task Force. And he's going to be talking to us about what we need to be doing in this hour of crisis. We'll take a brief break and we'll be right back. Okay, we're back. I needed a deep breath after the right one. Susan L. Taylor. We called it the essence of Susan L. Taylor, phenomenal black woman, and you know why we did that. Well, now we want to get back to the COVID-19 coronavirus epidemic, or pandemic, I'm sorry. And I mentioned it earlier, we have a lot of resources that we're aggregating with the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. One of the persons who's worked with us for many, many years is Brother Yousef Muhammad. He is a past president of the International Black Professional Firefighters and much more than that. And he is a specialist in this area of disaster preparedness and relief. And we're delighted that, as I said before, he is the co-chair, along with Dr. Lucy Perez, who is a past president of the National Medical Association, that's the black doctors, of the FEMA, Black Family Summit Emergency Management Task Force. Brother Yousef Muhammad, welcome to Vantage Point.
Thank you so much, Dr. Daniels. Good to be on the journey with you. Good to be on the program with our dear sister, Susan Taylor, phenomenal woman. I'm just happy to be on the program and overwhelmed to be able to serve your listening audience.
Well, let's start with that, Brother Yousef. We've been having all these conversations. We had over 75 people on a call, emergency call, on this past Friday with many of our healing organizations. Just an incredible outpouring of eagerness to respond to this crisis. Just give us your sort of opening message to our audience about the seriousness of this crisis.
Well, it's certainly serious, and being where you are there in New York and in the Northeast, which is really the hot zone right now, each individual citizen, capable man, woman, child, need to take responsibility for themselves. So first, they should stay informed, whether you're listening to your state or local authorities and listening to the various things you should do, whether it has to do with social distancing or practicing good hygiene. You know, the thing about this COVID-19, as I do my research, there are two parts. It's the fluidity of every moment and every hour where things change. And then the other part is we can't assume that everyone knows what you know. So the basics will always be regarding disaster awareness for community preparedness is to, number one, get informed. Number two, to make a plan. Number three, develop what you need to develop and then reassess your plan and your whatever it is you're developing to build up your immune system, if you will, both physically, mentally, and spiritually. And once you do that assessment, make the necessary corrections. That's as an individual. Then as a community, every time you talk about disaster, you're really considering community involvement, community investment, community partnership. It's a cycle. where they're all related as you engage in community risk reduction. So, okay, one of the things is to stay calm. Well, how do you do it? Sister Susan Taylor said, what really matters in life? We have to, if I could use her words, get in the spirit. So whether you're believing in a supreme being, if prayer, meditation, these type of things. Stevie Wonder had a song in the Songs of the Key of Life called Just Go Have a Talk with God. That's how you really stay calm, to get your spirit balanced. But then you have to really understand, in building your immune system, you want to eat the proper foods. If you can grow food, you want to do that. And you know, Grandmama used to have canning and exercise is always important. And she mentioned the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, and you know, as Muslims, that navy bean is critically important to put in your diet. It's about building your vitamin C, your vitamin D. Get as much sunshine as you can. And lastly, you want to disinfect your homes, turn your home into educational institution, particularly if you have children, even a house of worship, if you will. So you start there with yourself, and then it branches out into the community, involvement, investment, partnership, or risk reduction.
Great words to begin us off. And again, I just wanted to thank you so much for the contributions you've made over the years. Talk to us about the FEMA Black Family Summit Emergency Management Task Force. For our audience who doesn't know what it is, give us a view of what it is and what it does.
Well, it's interesting that Sister Taylor also talked about the birth of the National CARES as a result of Hurricane Katrina. And as you know, because of you and Baba Leonard Dunstan, the President Emeritus of the Black Social Workers, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan made a suggestion, and the both of you moved out and began convening 25 to 30 national Black organizations. And since then, with the help of Sister Nell Prim, Dr. Prim, and others, been meeting every other week for since Hurricane Katrina, if you will. And then, of course, Superstorm Sandy was another indicator. And so what we do is we try to connect with, under President Obama's administration, we were able to, with your help, connect with Craig Fugate, who was the chief administrator of FEMA at that time, and develop relationships where we could hopefully have a greater impact on policy, not to mention when these disasters strike certain areas, you know, a term, cultural competency, is something that we focused on as a collaboration of Black organizations to assist our people, because prior to that, and we noticed in studying how the mitigation of the people in New Orleans, it lacked a lot of cultural competency, and thus, you know, the organization of the Black Family Summit saw it fit to try to collaborate partnership with FEMA, as well as attempts with the American Red Cross. But in the final analysis, we have the expertise in the Black Family Summit to do for self and do what's necessary. But no matter what the disaster, you know, the beauty about disaster, as Sister said again, it's almost like an equal opportunity employer and or destroyer. You know, disasters, they don't recognize holidays, vacations, days off, union breaks, lunch breaks. It's non-discriminatory. But we have a role to play, and the Black Family Summit has committed themselves since Hurricane Katrina to be a part of that group of people to serve. It's about service.
And that's been some 15 years. It is really amazing that the All Healers Mental Health Alliance, which is convened by Dr. Anel Prim, and, of course, Baba Leonard Dunstan representing the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, even though ALMA, as it's called, is a part of the Black Family Summit. By the way, which includes organizations like the National Association of Black Social Workers, the Black Psychiatrists of America, the Association of Black Psychologists, Administrators in Black Child Welfare. It is, like you said, now up to 29 socially conscious black professional organizations and advocates that come together under the leadership of Baba Leonard Dunstan to deal with a range of different questions affecting our people. But particularly this task force has just done an incredible job and done it free. I mean, there's no funding out here, unfortunately, and we got to fight for that because Susan Taylor was just talking about the funds that are going to be coming down for nonprofits and so forth, making sure that black people, we get our hands on it because, you know, all too often this work is done free, a labor of love. But that labor of love would sure be a lot more profound in some ways if we had greater capacity. But it's been done, you know, largely with no resources. But it has addressed, as you said before, so many of these different crises. I want to now just turn to the task at hand, because you and Dr. Perez have been tasked with and have produced a fact sheet that gives some basic information that, if it's not up now, will very shortly be up on the IBW website at ibw21.org. But talk to us about the process of the different organizations that are coming together that are working with you and Dr. Perez to help produce culturally competent. By culturally competent, we mean the kind of messages that black people understand. Let me just be plain about that. But talk to us about the organizations, amazing groups that are coming together under one umbrella. They're not surrendering their organizational sovereignty and all that kind of stuff, but a sense of Ujima, collective work and responsibility to help produce the fact sheets and the messages that need to get out in our community.
Yes, sir. Well, it is a blessing that all of these organizations are coming together now, and it's no accident. You know, our elder, our ancestor, Sister Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, used to say, when you talk about activities of daily living in people's lives, and disaster, again, impacts all areas of people's lives, be it education, entertainment, economics, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war. And all of these organizations, national organizations, fit up under one of those categories where they're experts in what it is that their mission statement and vision statement speaks to. And so the fact that technology today allows us to come together on whether it's webinars or teleconferences is just such a blessing to be able to know who's working in what field. We're all in the vineyard. Some of our mission statements overlap. Some of them, as you said, we keep satellite organizations where you keep your autonomy. And I must say, shout out to Dr. Perez, Lucy Perez, former president of the National Medical Association, the Black Doctors, and the president, current president of the International Association of Black Professional Firefighters, Addington Stewart, who, again, the doctors do what they do and what they're born to do. The firefighters do what they do and what they're born to do, as well as the psychiatrists, the psychologists, the all mental health healers, the social workers. It's just a beautiful thing that these organizations have committed themselves to do the work that needs to be done, particularly in crisis.
Yeah, and I've been delighted. The historical Meharry Medical College, a storied institution, have been on the calls and are working with you and getting information out. Again, the National Medical Association being involved. And it's just so many different organizations that have come to the forefront, you know, to be involved. Dr. Benjamin F. Chavis, of course, the president and CEO of the National Newspaper Publishers Association, which is the largest configuration of black newspapers all across the country. The National Black Nurses Association involved as well. So I just want to give the people a sense of all of the organizations that are coming together under this incredible effort. But as we close, you do this work every week. This is not just a new thing for you. You specialize in this. You have your own medium of broadcasting. You've been holding town hall meetings on the airwaves. So tell people about your show.
Well, I thank you. Every Friday from 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I co-host a radio station, a radio program entitled Disaster Awareness for Community Preparedness. My co-host is Brother Rudolph Muhammad, who has over 30 years of the emergency medical services under his belt. And in fact, his father, God be pleased with him, Commander James Robinson of the Bedside Volunteer Ambulance Corps, which was one of the first, if not the first, private black-owned ambulance corps in America, established in the late 60s and the early 70s. And many of the members of the Fire Department of New York give credit to the Bed-Stuy Volunteer Ambulance Corps for getting them through the Academy of the Fire Service. Anyway, Brother Rudolph is my co-host, and we speak about everything from viruses to vaccines, from flu to health and fitness, from fire safety education to community risk reduction. And so if your listening audience is interested, you can tune in every Friday from 4 to 6 o'clock p.m. by logging on to blogtalkradio.com/blackholeradio, whole spelled W-H-O-L-E, or call 563-999-3089, and you'll be able to, you know, come into our program. So thank you, Dr. Daniels, for giving
all
me
right.
this opportunity.
Well, that music in the background, Dr. Yusuf Muhammad, means it's time for me to get off the airways here. We appreciate you so much for being
appreciate
with us this
you,
afternoon
sir.
And sharing this information. And to our listening audience, once again, go to the IBW website, IBW21.org. Look for the section on coronavirus. You'll see a number of articles there. We'll continue to give this information to you. Next Monday, our guest will be none other than the Honorable Roz J. Baraka, Mayor of the City of Newark, New Jersey, as we have our State of Newark monthly report. That's next Monday here on Vantage Point. This is the Professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, saying keep safe, be safe, keep the faith, and be safe. We'll see you again here next week on Vantage Point, 99.5 FM on WBAI.